have another guest here from the Savannah Book Festival telling the story of the electric guitar, which revolutionized American music in the mid-20th century. But how it got from this to this. Primarily due to the lifelong rivalry of two men, Leo Fender and Les Paul. Music writer and editor Ian Port traces the thoroughly engrossing history of two visionaries who could not have been more different in his book, The Birth of Loud. Ian Port, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, a little background on these two men. Born Clarence Leo Fender and Lester Palfus, not a great stage name, but both inveterate tinkers, both gained fame and lots of money by making a new, this relatively quiet acoustic instrument loud. And you tell a story of Les Paul doing that in night, and he was in Waukesha, Wisconsin, only 14 years old, playing a solo gig. What motivated him to make his guitar louder?
Well, Les wanted to be heard, and, you know, when he was a little kid playing at a barbecue stand outside of Waukesha, his hometown, he was told by a car hop outside of a roadside diner there that the audience couldn't hear him, could hear him singing, because he was plugged in through a microphone, but not his guitar. So the story goes that one night, Les grabbed the phonograph needle from his father's record set, jabbed it into the top of his acoustic guitar, the soundboard, plugged the end of that into a radio, which is basically like what we now think of as a guitar amplifier, and played his guitar through the radio, and voila, he was heard. And from then on, Les was basically on a direct path to amplifying his electric guitar.
He made a little more money that gig, right?
Yes, he did. The tips doubled, he said, as he would like to tell it that way.
Well, Leo Fender couldn't be more different. He couldn't carry a tune or a beat, but he did have a radio repair business at the age of 13, so another prodigy.
Leo was a technical wizard. No one had high expectations for him as a kid. He was kind of today what we would now think of as like sort of a more introverted, sort of nerdy type guy. But he was a wizard at manipulating electronic circuitry and at kind of conjuring sounds out of radio technology. And that's really how he got into building electric guitars. The guitar amplifier, as I said, it's not that different from a radio. So musicians came to him eventually looking for him to fix their guitar amplifiers. He said, hey, I can build a better one. And one thing led to another.
Yeah, and there's an aha moment for him. This is at a 1946 with Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. What happened?
Well, so, you know, Fender was famous for, he would build amplifiers for the musicians of Southern California, which at the time was a real hotbed of country music. It was actually the biggest country music market in the country at the time. And Fender loved country music. He would build amplifiers for these musicians. And if one of these groups was playing on stage and their amplifier sounded in a way that Leo Fender didn't like, he would be there and he would climb up on stage in the middle of the concert and start tinkering with the amp while they were playing a song. And he was famous for this. Finally, musicians got so tired of it that they had to tell him to stop doing that. And he got the point eventually, but he would do that, yeah.
Well, both Les and Leo were laughed at when they brought, you know, their hulking prototypes to guitar makers. But you illustrate how revolutionary the electric guitar was using the 1964 show. It's actually a movie. It was in movie theaters. Mm-hmm. Teenage Awards Music International, or TAMI. There's Jan and Dean. There's the Supremes. And here we have the Beach Boys. That all of us can recognize. There was also on that bill James Brown, Marvin Gaye, and the Rolling Stones. Let's hear a little of them. So two very different sounds there. But, you know, guitars had been, as you said, amplified but not electrified. So what is significant? What was unleashed with this sound?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine now just how different people thought of electric guitar back then. You know, initially it was like you plug in, you put some electronics in an acoustic guitar. It makes it a little bit louder, but it doesn't really like change the sound. And what we're talking about in this book is really the leap from that kind of acoustic era to the electric era, where they're saying, let's go fully electric. Let's commit to this. Let's build the body out of solid wood. And then it can get as loud as it wants because it doesn't feed back. And then you get that kind of piercing electrical sound that we hear with the Stones there and which the Beach Boys, which was really so different and so much louder and more powerful than what they had before.
But, you know, you also point out that, you know, there's no orchestra anymore. There's no sheet music. So what did that allow in American music?
Sure. So the one amazing sort of byproduct of this technical leap was that suddenly you didn't need 12 musicians on stage anymore to fill a room, right? Suddenly, when you had an 80-watt Fender amplifier on stage, or three or four of them, you know, four musicians like the Beach Boys could fill a room like the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium where the Tammy Show was filled. And that really changed the kind of sound and look in music. It also kind of deprofessionalized music in a way, because suddenly, an amateur playing three chords on a guitar could make as much racket as a professional orchestra with a band leader and tuxedos and musicians reading music off of paper. So the electrification really changed the way that music sounded and looked and felt.
And goodbye, right? Yeah. My guest is Ian Port. He's a former music editor for San Francisco Weekly. He's written for Rolling Stone, The Believer, and his book, we're talking about how the birth of the loud, that's his book, Leo Fender, Les Paul, and the guitar pioneering rivalry that shaped rock and roll. So Leo Fender, he started a booming business, mass producing inexpensive Esquire guitars, where they were called, gobbled up by hungry teens. Les Paul used frequent TV appearances with a singer and wife, Mary Ford, and worked with Gibson to sell his guitar. Now, they had worked together at one point, right?
What happened? That was what was so fascinating to me about this story. You know, everyone knows, like, the Fender Stratocaster and the Gibson Les Paul are kind of like, they're like the Apple and Microsoft of the electric guitar world, like the huge rivals. But before they were rivals, these two guys were tinkering together in a Hollywood garage way back in the late 40s, trying to find a different sound for the electric guitar. Les Paul was trying to find a sound that would make him famous because he wanted to be a star. And he thought, hey, if I get a cool electric guitar tone, I will suddenly not just be a sideman, I will be a star. Leo Fender, as you said, wanted to start a business. He had a fledgling kind of instrument company. And he felt that if he could mass produce electric instruments, then his, you know, his company would find success. And sure enough, that's what happened. But yeah, back in the day, they did work together. And it wasn't until the first Fender electric guitar came on the market, the Telecaster, that their friendship kind of fractured into a rivalry.
It's the story of American business.
Yes.
Sometimes cutthroat, yeah. By the way. But they had some extremely influential ambassadors of the sound, the surf rocker Dick Dale, a great, great series of stories about him working with Leo Fender, Muddy Waters, Growling Blues, Buddy Holly on the Ed Sullivan Show. So what did their influence mean for these competing guitar makers and the future, really, of rock music?
So much. I mean, it was so interesting to watch and to do the research and learn how, over the course of the 50s, all the guitar players tried the Gibson model or the Fender model. Gradually, they kind of came to favor the Fenders through the late 50s, and it wasn't until the mid-60s that Gibson really saw its resurgence into the kind of prominence that it has today with the Les Paul model. But, you know, these instruments really gave artists a new kind of voice, a new palette of sounds to work with. And that was what was so fun to do the research and watch that happen.
Well, and getting deep with these stories with musicians Carole Kaye, players like F.C. Hall. He left his job as the premier Fender salesman and bought the Rickenbacker Guitar Company, the choice of one extremely influential band. What did that mean? The Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. Seems like everybody of a certain generation watched it, and they had a Rickenbacker guitar. They had Rickenbacker guitars.
They did. So F.C. Hall, as you mentioned, had been the sort of financier of Fender early on. He got kicked out, bought Rickenbacker, and then unbeknownst to anyone, this random band from England that almost no one in the United States has heard of, much less wanted to be successful, showed up playing these Rickenbacker guitars. And overnight, Rickenbacker's business exploded, and the Fender people who were sitting there across town, literally like 5 miles away, saw their rival kind of have their business transformed overnight, and suddenly the biggest band in the world didn't play Fenders. It was a huge deal. And really, of course, now we associate the Beatles with Rickenbackers.
Well, these stories are so compelling. There's, you talk about Eric Clapton, Bob Dylan, Rolling Stones, deeply influenced by Buddy Holly, Muddy Waters, these early guitar heroes, let's say. Eric Clapton, playing with the Blues Breakers, played this kind of growling, gravelly guitar. And there's such a story there of Clapton buying a guitar for Jimi Hendrix while he was visiting London. Can you share that with us?
Yeah. So Clapton was set to jam with Jimi Hendrix a couple days into September 1970. He'd gone to found a white Stratocaster, which was sort of Jimmy's preferred look, and was going to bring it to him to the jam, only to find out that earlier that morning, I believe, Hendrix had died in his London apartment of his girlfriend. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the two of them were kind of chief rivals on the London blues scene, and you know, Clapton had related to Jimmy in a certain way, but you know, he was devastated by that loss, obviously.
But the guitar symbol there, what does knowing the stories of these two men and their influence add to our understanding of American music?
I think it just shows, you know, kind of the persistence of creativity and this how far people will go to get that creative drive out into the world, and how fierce these people fought to be heard.
Well, we're going to leave you with Muddy Waters playing Hoochie Coochie Man as we thank you, Ian Port.
Thank you very much.
He's going to be talking about his book, The Birth of Loud, tomorrow at the Lutheran Church Sanctuary at 11:20. That's at the Savannah Book Festival. Now, coming up, Tina Clark. She's a Grammy-winning music producer and now author. She's at the Baptist Church Sanctuary at 10 tomorrow morning for the Savannah Book Festival. And we're going to talk with her about her memoir. That's when On Second Thought continues.
Past 21, I want you to believe me, baby. I have lots of fun. I'm a man. Yeah! I spell him H-I.